Accession number 28361, Reel 50.
General Julian Thompson, Royal 50.
You're saying the Pucaras and Aeromachis were very dangerous to troops on the ground and helicopters.
Well, the Aeromachis were more dangerous to troops on the ground than the fast movers, because they could see them. And they were designed as ground attack aircraft in counterinsurgency. But the main danger of the Pucara was against helicopters, because they could fly slow enough to take on helicopters, and they were all stationed in the islands, so they were there all the time and could appear without any warning whatsoever. They didn't have to fly from Argentina to get to us.
We didn't actually have armed helicopters at that time, did we?
No, not proper armed helicopters. We had armed helicopters to this extent, that the scout could be equipped with an SS-11, and was designed. The scout was the anti-tank helicopter.
I think you're also saying that the Argentines attempted to attack the troops at Goose Green, but they were seen off by. Effectively by massed rifle fire or by all weapons?
When they attacked the half battery supporting the Goose Green attack, and they were seen off by people firing GPMGs at them, and even I think an anti-tank weapon. They also attacked two para Goose Green when they were in the final stages of the battle, and they were actually seen off there by blowpipe and GPMGs firing at them. In fact, a blowpipe shot one down.
This is real close air support.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they were shooting at two para, attacking two para when they were deployed on the forward slopes overlooking Goose Green.
So, how far would two para have been from the Argentinian positions?
About 1,500 meters.
So that's quite a good safety margin.
Well,
from day one, when the Argentine aircraft started appearing overhead and taking action, did they cause you personally a sense of apprehension for the operation and its safety?
Yes, they did. Because I thought the day they'd sink the amphibious ships and logistic ships, I thought that they would shoot down all our helicopters. And if we tried flying helicopters forward of the sort of air defense umbrella, that's perhaps the wrong word to use, because it implies that it kept everything on, but the air defense system of San Carlos, they would get shot down because there was no protection for them once they flew out beyond, particularly if they were carrying loads like guns and ammunition, where they were highly unmaneuverable. And that was one of the reasons why I had no intention of moving out of the beachhead until the Argentine air had been whittled down somewhat, which of course it was by day six or seven. It had lost a lot of airplanes, mainly of course to the Harriers, the Sea Harriers.
Was there a point at which you began to be less concerned because of the Argentines not using their aircraft in the most effective manner?
Not really. I'm still concerned. When we started the Goose Green battle, which we'll come on to later, I should imagine. And in fact, my worries about Argentine air caused me to, for example, not allow CVRT to go down and take part in the battle, which was a wrong decision. But they certainly proved how dangerous they were by shooting down one of my helicopters during the Goose Green battle.
When you got your chaps ashore on day one, they'd arrived in the morning.
Yeah.
Some of them in the daylight, some of them earlier on. What was your first priority? Was it to establish a perimeter against a possible move against you by Argentinian ground forces, or did you have other things in mind?
That was the first priority. It was to establish a beachhead defence in case the Argentine ground forces came and attacked us, which seemed to me to be a logical thing for them to do, especially as they had rather more helicopters than we had, and therefore they could have done it if they wanted to.
Were you thinking in terms of a direct helicopter assault, or of them dropping their chaps a distance away and then forming up and coming forward on their feet?
Well, I rather hope they'd do a direct helicopter assault. We'd have actually assaulted them, you know, we would have absolutely massacred them, but I thought even they wouldn't be that stupid, and they would probably land somewhere away and after reconnaissance, mount attacks on the beachhead, which they didn't do.
Presumably they could have done air reconnaissance with their Picaros and...
There's no reason for them not to have done it. Yeah. We would have done it, we had the boot been on the other foot. But they didn't. The most frustrating thing about that day was the lack of communication, which is something that I expected after years and years and years of working in the LPDs, because the land force radios on board the LPD shared the same antenna as the maritime sets. Don't ask me how it works, I haven't the slightest idea, and I didn't understand it then, and I still don't understand how you can have several radios all using the same antennas, but apparently you can. Now, the problem with that is the maritime sets, being more powerful than the others, blank out the sort of piddling little signals you get from a man-packed set ashore, and so I wasn't getting any. After the first few sort of crackles of the radio, remember we'd come in on radio silence.
Yeah.
And the other thing was, I was discovering it took about 24 hours to get these ancient sets sort of netted in properly. And so if you start with radio silence and you can't open a radio up until HR, you then got 24 hours to get your act together. Now that first 24 hours is actually usually pretty critical, and it proved to be no exception on this occasion. And I wasn't getting any reports.
Well, these 22 cents, the old Manpack 22 cents, the one that had the dial and the cursor too.
These were Klansman sets.
Oh, Klansman.
These were Klansman, but they're still underpowered when they're competing against a set putting out I don't know how many megawatts from a ship. And the facts of life were we were not getting, the communications were bloody awful.
Were you thinking in terms of having a single perimeter by the end of day one, or of having two perimeters each around?
Oh, no, it wasn't all joined up. No. I didn't have enough troops to do that. All I did was I had perimeters around the beachhead, and if they had infiltrated down, I would have had to mount counterattacks or something to get rid of them. But there was no way I was going to be able to have a continual line of troops right around this area.
Well,
it was
I was just thinking your actual landing beaches are really rather widely dispersed, aren't they?
Yeah, they are.
And so you'd have in effect two enclaves ashore.
Yeah.
Defensible enclaves.
You have more. You have four actually. Four.
You've got the flank guard.
One there, and the flank guard there, which is a sort of fourth. But that doesn't matter because that beachhead is unlikely to be attacked.
That's Red Beach.
That's Red Beach, which is the only way to get at it effectively, is like this or by sea. But yeah. I put 4 or 5 commando there, and they were really one of my reserves, so I could then move them to wherever they were required. Initially, I had 4-2 commando this is the first day, in Canberra there, as my reserve afloat, but I then decided I'd land them before the ship got sunk. I then had 3 para there.
That's at Port St. Carlos.
Green Beach. And the reason that I landed like that was because I didn't want to sort of land in one beach and then have to send chaps bloody miles around in order to provide me with defence. These were key areas which I needed to hold, and from there I could mount counterattacks or take action against enemy that tried to interfere with my operations here.
And then from Blue Beach, you'd had that deployment south to Sussex Mountains,
Sussex
Black
Mountain.
Guard.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you have anyone on Fanning Head?
No.
You didn't have an OP party there?
I may have had an OP, I can't remember. There may have been an OP there, but no, not really. I wasn't really worried about Fanning Head.
What sort of structures were there at San Carlos and at Port San Carlos? Were there buildings that you could use in any way for your purposes?
There were settlements. San Carlos, I suppose, I suppose there are about 50 to 100 people living in each of these.
Yes.
In pretty rudimentary buildings. Hmm.
These wooden structures,
or tin, mainly, because there isn't much wood in the Falkland. So they were pre-constructed stuff that had been taken, prefabs that had been there for 100 years.
Yeah.
And some of them, sheep shearing sheds. I can actually picture the sort of buildings they were like. But I wasn't going to use the buildings, except for headquarters and one big building here, which was an old mutton processing factory.
Yes.
Was my logistic area and became my field dressing station when Canberra was taken away. It wasn't intended to be the field dressing station in the first place. But on the whole, I discouraged people using the buildings because I didn't want the inhabitants turfed out of their houses with lots of Marines and paratroopers. In any case, there's no point in being in the buildings because the way to defend these places was to be out on the terrain outside, not in the village, not in the settlements themselves.
Yeah. Buildings were not tactically sited.
No.
Mm. I was going to ask you what you did with the civilian inhabitants of
these settlements.
They stayed
in their houses.
They just stayed there and carried on.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Absolutely.
Was there anything they could tell you that might be of value?
No. Nothing other than saying there's no enemy here, because they had been cut off from talking to other settlements, because they used to talk on a sort of CB radio, and the Argentines had come and taken all their sets away from them, so they couldn't communicate with each other except on the telephone.
And did the telephone keep working?
Telephone kept working, and thereby hang several tales which will come on to.
Now, quite often, if you're setting up a defensible perimeter or position perimeters, and you want them to be fairly well fortified, an important thing is to get engineer stores in as quickly as possible. Were you able to do that, to get in things like Wrigley tin and?
Yeah, well, we had some
shovels, Royal Engineers, and all the other sort of things.
Well, we had some. I didn't want to land too much because otherwise landing Wrigley tin was going to take priority over landing ammunition and supplies. And remember, I had very few means of getting the stuff in. Yeah. And once you land, the only way to get Wrigley tin up onto the position was by taking it by helicopter. There was no road, and there was no point in dumping it on the beach. It then had to be got from there, perhaps 2,000 meters away to a position on the side of a hill.
Long carry for a piece of Wrigley tin.
Absolutely. So defence stores were pretty low priority, except for some round the gun positions, a few CPs, and I had some combat engineer tractors, which were new toys, which had just been delivered to the Royal Engineers, which didn't normally form part of my establishment, but my sapper, Roddy MacDonald, an officer of great resource, had managed to persuade the engineers that this would be a good trial for them.
And how did they perform?
Fantastic, because they could swim.
Ah.
They were fantastic. And they were the latest bit of kit. And they were like an APC with a bucket on the front. And they could fire grapnels to pull themselves out of trouble. They were still under trial. They were terrific bits of kit. The only problem is they were terribly heavy, so they weren't much good across the peat. But they could get to some places. And so, for example, they dug my CP. They dug gun positions.
Well, they had some kind of grab at
a bucket.
Oh, I see, like a JCB.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they were like a JCB, an armoured JCB with tracks. So the answer to your question is we didn't land loads of barbed wire and stuff like that. A, because we weren't aiming to spend much time there.
Yeah.
And B, the administrative effort of sort of moving it would take priority over much more important things.
And what about mines? Were you putting
we had mines, but we never laid any.
You didn't?
No.
Why was that? Was there a reason for not
again,
putting them out?
Why do you want to spend a lot of effort putting mines out when you're not going to spend a lot much time there?
Well, if you think you might have the enemy might, if the enemy are sensible, the thing to do is nip it in the bud and have a very quick counterattack, isn't it? Before you're fully sorted on the position.
Absolutely. No, but they didn't. That was a risk we had to take. But I wasn't going to spend my precious helicopter resources moving loads of mines up to put a minefield out, which I then was not going to hope to be, I wasn't going to stay there.
You'd have to lift it, wouldn't you?
I'd have to lift it. I'd have to mark it properly, which means more helicopters lifting in 6-foot pickets and wire.
Tape
and all that sort of. It just wasn't worth it, quite frankly.
Did you take a close interest in what sort of positions they actually dug at company level and so on, or did you let them get on with it?
I let them get on with it. I told them, the things that I told them that I wanted was that I wanted the position to be on reverse slopes. So they were not immediately obvious to people coming the other way, for all the obvious reasons. And I left it to the COs. I wasn't going to tell them how to lay their battalions out. I left it to them entirely.
Did they do that satisfactorily?
I didn't go around and inspect each position, but from what I saw when I went round, they looked okay.
When were you first able to get ashore and have a look at the actual ground for yourself then?
Well, this is what I'm coming on to. And it all comes back to communications.
You couldn't hear from them because the
radio. No, so I had to go and see them.
Yeah.
That was the only answer, to go and find out. In the meanwhile, I heard that two of my helicopters had been shot down. That was about what a bit of information I'd got. Quite why that happened, we still don't know to this day. We suspect that the Gazelles of one of the flights picked up the fact that enemy had been seen retreating from Port San Carlos in front of the Three Para and had fired at a Sea King, which was trying to drop a rapier in this area here. And the Sea King had gone. So this, and you were asking me about armed helicopters. The other thing we'd done is we'd fitted SNEB rockets onto some of the Gazelles, which is not what they were designed for, but again, it was a sort of
stopgap
effort, and we never used them in anger. Unfortunately, it gave two Gazelle pilots the idea that they were sort of flying typhoons or something, I suppose. And one of them must have heard, and he's dead now, so we never ask him, this exchange about this helicopter, because without being fired on, without any by or lead, he zoomed off to have a look at it and was shot down.
What shot him down? Ground fire or...?
Yeah, ground fire from these Argentines who were running away from Three Para here.
So this is the half company?
And they shot at him with GPMGs.
And that brought him down. He must have been very low to be caught.
He was very low. He was flying at about 20, 30 feet. That's where our helicopters always flew low here. They never flew above 100 feet because of the air problem. And so he was coming in and was shot down, and the pilot was killed. The air gunner survived and dragged the pilot out of the helicopter. He was dying, actually. He wasn't dead straight away. And swam with him to where the local settlement villagers were standing. San Carlos.
Well, he came down over the water.
Oh, he came down over the water.
So how far did he have to swim with this fellow?
About 100 yards.
That's amazing.
Being shot at by the Argies.
As he was swimming away.
As he was swimming away, yeah.
Now that would count as being foul play, wouldn't it?
Yes, it was foul play.
A man swimming with a wounded man in tow.
It was foul play, they did it, they missed him. And being encouraged by the settlement people who stand there saying, eventually he was pulled out, and he survived the air gunner.
So he's swimming into Port San Carlos, and the locals are cheering him on. The Argentines are shooting at him.
Anyway, he survived. However, the pilot must have got a radio message off about this enemy, because he was then followed up by another Gazelle. This time, they were shot down. This time, both were killed, and the aircraft crashed into the ground. They were both dead. That was all I heard. And so I was getting, by this time, pretty frustrated.
sounds like throwing good money after bad, doesn't it?
Yes,
really?
It does. I mean, it wasn't deliberate.
Or the second pilot presumably reacting emotionally
exactly.
and going
exactly.
in. Do you think he thought he was going in on a rescue or protective?
Well, he might have been. You know, he had his wretched Sneb rockets on board. I don't know what he was doing. He's dead. So I can't ask him. He didn't say anything.
It's
a great mystery. Yeah. I mean, to this day, nobody knows why he went. Mm. Nobody knows.
So we can only speculate.
As I say, by this time I was getting pretty hacked off and not knowing what was going on, and I said, I'm off to find out what's going on, which was pretty usual, because the way I normally commanded was that I would rove by helicopter.
Yeah.
I would send my TAC headquarters ashore as a foot on the ground, and my main would unload usually that first night and go to wherever I decided to go. So by 24 hours after D-Day, I would have my full headquarters up and running ashore, and I'd transfer ashore because of the appalling communications in Fearless, which also had other jobs. I mean, it could be taken out to do something else, and so there was no point in me staying on board.
So you might have been sailed away.
I might have been sailed away. I mean, there was talk the first day of them going to sea, you know, in all this air attack, the sort of first reaction, dare I say it, among some of the dark blue, and not in any sort of cowardly sense, was, you know, we've got to bugger off to see it and only come in at night. You know, I thought, well, this is nonsense. I can't command a brigade like this.
Of course, well, Fearless was supposed to be a headquarters ship, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. But she had two roles, you see.
Yes.
She was a headquarters ship, but she was also a primary landing craft ship. So, whereas in the Second World War, headquarters ships were headquarters ships and nothing else.
Usually in destroyers, as I
remember. They could go where the commander wanted them to go. Mm. Fearless had to be where she could control the boat lanes. So it was a dual role. You know, they hadn't learned the lessons from the Second World War, but do we ever? This was the problem. My aim was to get ashore fast as possible. What I then did, I summoned my helicopter, which took time to arrive, because every time it approached the ship, it would be waved away by the ship, because there's an air attack coming in, and the captain was worried lest his gunners should shoot down my helicopter by mistake. Well, eventually, anyway, I got into the helicopter, by which time it was about lunchtime, and went round seeing how things were going on. And at last, I felt I had control of the situation, because I could actually talk to people. And I went and saw everybody. The only people I didn't see were two para, because by the time I'd gone round and had a look at the ground and chatted to people and done various things, it was getting dark, and so I wasn't going to fly a helicopter into a strange place in the middle of the night or in the darkness. So by the end of that first day, I was feeling pretty confident. We got most of the chaps ashore. Things were going well, slowly but well.
What was the mood of the commanders and soldiers on the ground?
They were full of beans.
Oh, they were. So they lost that apprehension they had when
they were
loading.
They were full of beans, and in a way, seeing all these air attacks helped, because it made them realise this was for real. You know, this wasn't an exercise.
This is a war.
This is a war. And so everyone was, and you know, when they saw, two parrots sitting here, watched Arden being attacked and sunk in front of their eyes. So they could see this, you know, this was for real. And so no one was in any doubt what this was about, and people had managed to sort of get loose off live rounds of airplanes and sort of get themselves into the mood, which was actually quite a good thing.
And they were still alive?
And they were still alive.
Had they had any casualties at that stage, apart from the chap who was crushed between the landing craft and
the
Norland?
Only casualties that, to my people, were the
two
pilots and one air gunner.
So everyone on the ground was undamaged?
I was undamaged at this stage, yeah. Yeah,
right.
Totally.
So that probably explained why it was that they were in a much better frame of mind.
Well, they were undamaged, and
they'd been under fire.
They'd
done the landing, which is the most dangerous bit, isn't it? Really,
and it had worked.
And it had worked.
Yeah.
And they were ashore. They were dug in.
Sure. And so they were ready to go. And so morale was good, very high, no problems at all.
Did they think that there might be an Argentine ground force heading for them?
Yes, they did.
And what did they think about that?
Well, they were, hooray, let them come, you know. We'll sort them out. I mean, we had guns in position who had registered targets. The mortars were in and had registered their targets. Mm. Patrols were out in front. Oh. So we would have had plenty of warning. And the last thing I did before last light was to push my recce troop right forward, about 40 kilometres ahead of me, onto the key high ground.
How did they go forward? Did they go by helicopter?
They went by helicopter.
Yeah.
They went by helicopter. Onto the key high ground, which runs like this out in front here.
Yeah.
See, I'm here. And the reason I wanted them all the way forward, I mean, they were right forward to as far as here.
That's virtually overlooking Stanley, isn't
yeah, well
it?
Yeah, well, no, it's a long way. No, the high ground here overlooks
Stanley. Right,
yes. But what it does do is it overlooks the route that I was going to use with helicopters, and it turned out, of course, they didn't, which would give me that way. And also, I had put SBS in to recce this place, Teal Inlet, because the next thing I was going to do was take ships around here and use this as my forward supply base.
So that would be a hopping forward.
Hopping forward logistics. Because though you couldn't get anything other than LSLs in through there.
Yes.
Any other ships had to offload out here, which would have been a waste of time. But the LSLs could get in here and put Mexi floats ashore at Teal Inlet. So you were actually cutting down the logistic distance by 2/3.
Presumably you'd have to have a protective force with that forward logistics.
Well, obviously that wasn't going to happen until I had traps forward here.
Yeah.
So that wasn't going to happen a minute before I had people. It was going to take some time.
So you need people then around the area of Evelyn Hill, Lower Marlow House, before you could do it. And in the meantime, you were putting them on what?
I had my recce was going forward onto the high ground here.
Okay, so this is the line roughly Bull Hill,
through
Bull
to
Mountain, the Onion, the Baby, Lower Marlow House.
Yeah.
So, in classical terms, you would describe that as an extreme outward picket, wouldn't
Indeed,
you?
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah. How many men have you got in the recce troop?
My recce troop was about 50, my brigade recce. And they were the Mountain and Arctic Warfare cadre. Their wartime role was my brigade recce. So they're all highly trained, at least mountain leader class 2 guys. They'd all done the long-range comms course at Hereford, so they could use HF sets on Morse key, on one-time pads, back to my recce troop headquarters, which was right alongside my brigade headquarters here.
So this forward screen, were they deployed in groups of 4 or 5?
Yeah,
or
patrols of 4.
And were they indivisible? Their OPs?
No, not necessarily. Right. But they could command ground in between. They could see ground in between.
So that they could command all the practicable routes forward
More
for troops
less.
Moving on the ground.
Yeah.
And
later, I can tell you when we come to it, they spotted the Argentine Special Forces coming in, and we were able to sort them out as a result.
Wow. So that was
So they were a very valuable
forward
source
screen.
Of highly trained chaps out on a forward screen. And they were there from D-Day evening right through till the end of the... I mean, they obviously moved once those positions became pointless to other places. And they were a highly important element in this whole thing. So we would have had very good warning of anybody coming, to answer your question.
They were... were they dug in hides, or were they...
They were little hides.
Little hides. How long would it take a patrol of 4 men to get themselves, as it were, undercover once they've been delivered into position?
Well, it depends really what the...
Certain amount of work to be done, isn't
what
there?
The situation, how they were going to do it. I mean, what they did was they had chicken wire, which they took with them, and then they would dig a hole, or they'd go into a crack among the rocks, because there are a lot of rocks there, huge fissures in the rocks, and you could go into a sort of fissures in the rocks and live in there, like sort of troglodytes. Or if there was nothing there, you could dig a hole in the peat, and then put peat turves on the chicken wire, which you laid over the top. And then you'd have a forward OP, which is probably the most exposed place, which could be quite small, because it would only take 2 people. And the other 2 would be back in a backup, where they could sleep, if you were lucky during the day, they could cook using hexamine cookers, or blueys they use quite a lot of the time. Obviously not cooking at night, but in the daytime. And where they could rest, and then change over at night. So the OP would be manned all day, change over at night, and be manned at the night as well. But you would switch people around.
Because at night it'd be more listening, wouldn't it?
It'd be listening, yeah. But they had the night division devices they would have had would be the individual weapon sight, the IWS on the SLR,
yes.
Of which we had 90 per commando or battalion. So that's 30 per company in round terms. Plus we've taken away some to give to the sort of recce troop and people like that. We didn't have many night viewing devices.
So it's some enhancement. Were you getting intelligence from it?